Studio 360 is supported by Hover, helping you get the best domain names to represent you or your business. If you want to get your ideas on the internet, Hover will help you find the right domain name and include all the tools and support you need to manage it. For 10% off your first purchase, go to hover.com and type in the promo code DESIGN.
Today in Studio 360, the secrets of making great music. I'll talk with a songwriter and former classical violinist whose stage name is Joan as Policewoman.
With each record, you know, I tell more of the voices in my head that say, you can't do this, you can't do that, to take a hike.
Hit me! And I get to talk with the pop record producer of our time, Rick Rubin. He has only one absolute rule in the studio.
We don't talk about what's going to get on the radio and what's going to, you know, how are we going to make our release date. We talk about how do we make this song as good as it could be.
That and lots more is ahead in this hour of Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Right after this.
You're crazy for this one, Rick. It's your boy.
Studio 360 is supported by Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. A few years ago, the artist known as Swoon got a bunch of her friends together and built boats out of garbage. Then they sailed them down the Mississippi and Hudson Rivers and through the Adriatic Sea to Venice. It all sounds like fiction, but these boats are real. And I got to board one.
All right. And now I got to climb up?
Yeah, climb up. It's a little dirty. And I don't know if that was the best spot, but you're up. So.
Okay.
I'll talk with the artist Swoon later in the show. But first, you know how a few years ago you started seeing notes on some articles online or signs outside theaters warning that the blog post or play might disturb some people in the audience? These so-called trigger warnings were designed to warn victims of real-life trauma to let them avoid reliving painful experiences. Recently, colleges have picked up the practice, including Rutgers, the University of California at Santa Barbara, and Oberlin College. At those schools, administrators are considering policies that would require professors to warn students about potentially off-putting content in books they assign, films they screen, presumably lectures they give that might upset the previously traumatized. And some people want to go much further. The draft of a new policy at Oberlin specifically cited Chinua Achebe's great novel Things Fall Apart for potentially triggering students who've experienced racism or colonialism or religious persecution. Katie McDonough, an editor at Salon, who's written about trigger warnings on campus, is here with me now. Katie McDonough, welcome to Studio 360.
Thanks for having me.
So you support trigger warnings in college classes. Explain yourself.
Well, I think that the idea of them on its face is actually not something that's censoring or harmful. I don't agree with them as a blanket policy. I don't believe that college professors should be at the mercy of administrators. It really is just, I think, trying to create spaces to talk about the way that students receive this material. And is it being done in a way that feels responsible, that acknowledges history and trauma and context?
What concerns me, or slightly disturbs me, I guess, is the sense of slippery slope PC-ness that suddenly, you know, as the proposal at Rutgers suggests that The Great Gatsby should be trigger warned for its misogynistic violence. Really?
I want to come out on the record and say that I love The Great Gatsby and have read it multiple times. I don't know that I would put a trigger warning on The Great Gatsby, but I would say when it's being taught in, let's say, a freshman literature class or a high school literature class, which is where I encountered it, do we talk about the misogyny or the domestic violence in that book? It doesn't necessarily need to be the primary focus of a conversation, but potentially we aren't really addressing some of these issues. We aren't creating campus environments that feel like survivors of sexual assault can sit in that classroom and feel heard and not feel like they're going to be re-victimized by the way that we talk about rape in this country, which is actually generally pretty terrible. If they don't feel like they can talk, if they don't feel that it's, you know, an environment where they're able to do that, I think that's a problem. I think that's censoring.
That's definitely a problem. Just as, let's say, Africans or African-Americans who have experienced racism and post-colonial problems are people you want in that classroom.
Absolutely.
Trigger possibilities aside.
If you don't want to call it a trigger warning, call it the work that professors and students need to be doing to talk about those dynamics, because they're at play, but they're not always directly addressed.
Do you have any worry, again, being a relatively recent college graduate, that because the world comes without trigger warnings of any kind, that even sort of making this a focus of things, oh, we need to protect these dear innocent 20-year-olds from problematic things, that that isn't good preparation for the world that they're about to face?
I don't think that protection is actually the word here. And I don't think that people who are survivors of various traumas who are asking for this sort of deeper conversation are saying, protect me. I think that they're saying, acknowledge me.
Uh-huh.
I don't exist in a space where I can somehow block out things that I don't want to hear.
Right.
So I think that this idea, and it seems to be this sort of popular narrative where, you know, is this going to be the end of the free press? Is this going to be the end of free speech as we know it? And frankly, my answer to that is no, it is not going to be.
No, I agree with you on that. But let's say Jewish students at a particular college say, Merchant of Venice, we can't read that. Or on the road, women say this is a misogynist, then we need trigger warnings about that. I mean, I can see both of those things happening. Would that be problematic in your view?
I see this as such an individual experience that if a given student sees that there's a text on a syllabus and goes to that professor and says, I've had this very specific experience, reading this book would be incredibly difficult for me, I believe that there are accommodations that can be made. And I actually don't believe that that's going to become some kind of a sweeping trend where students are going to be trying to weasel out of getting work done.
Yeah.
And then maybe that inspires the conversation with the professor that says, you know what? Okay, if you can't read it, you can't read it. We kind of do some different exercise and you do a different project while the class
is. Or what if I said, as the professor, well, I think you're closed-minded and you're closing yourself off to this experience. But if that's what you want to do, go ahead.
Or as a professor, you can say, you know what? I recognize that this is maybe a challenging text for you. I wonder what kind of systems or support I can put into place to help you read this in a way that makes you feel that it's possible for you,
right,
that you can actually engage with the material.
Right.
And I think fundamentally, that's what's at stake here, right? Which is saying that, do we have systems in place? Do we have faculty in place? Do we have kind of a cultural campus context in which students feel like they're going to get that support when they're doing the difficult work of reading things that can be challenging of a number of experiences and ideas that they have? All too often, I don't know that that's the case. And I think that's what you're seeing some of these students respond to by asking for trigger warnings.
Katie McDonough, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Katie McDonough is an editor at Salon.com. So if you've got some opinions on this debate, and I am sure you do, please share them at studio360.org.
Ever since Miss Susie Johnson lost her jockey lead, there's been so much excitement and more to be.
A couple of weeks ago, we asked you to send us your cover versions of an old classic, a song that's celebrating its 100th birthday this year. It's W.C. Handy's Yellow Dog Blues. The submissions so far range from the old-timey, this one from Carolyn Dixon in Santa Rosa, California.
He's gone to where the southern crosses the dog.
To the super groovy, this from a listener in San Marcos, Texas, who posted as City of Light. Our judge for this challenge is Mark Anthony Thompson, the songwriter better known as Chocolate Genius. You've still got time to send us your version. The deadline is June 1st, and all the information's at studio360.org. Coming up right now in Studio 360, Rick Rubin has worked with the biggest names in music, and a lot of his success is a function of his uncanny calm, which was challenged by the crazy schedule on Kanye West's latest album.
It is not how I work at all. I was panicky, and he was completely cool.
I get the rare chance to talk with Rick Rubin later this hour in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by TiVo, recording up to 6 shows at once and 3,000 hours, plus Netflix, Hulu Plus, and YouTube, all on the TiVo Romeo DVR. TiVo.com. And by Hover, helping you get the best domain names along with all the tools and support you need to manage them. When you want to get your ideas on the internet, Hover will help you find the right domain name to personalize your blog, business, portfolio, or cat videos. For 10% off your first purchase, go to hover.com and type in the promo code DESIGN.
You're listening to Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. Swoon is the pseudonym of one of the most interesting artists I've come across in a long time. She started on the margins 15 years ago, pasting her portraits on buildings and construction sites all over New York City. But don't imagine that work as some kind of standard graffiti. These were beautifully drawn portraits in a kind of old-timey woodcut style. Smiling kids or wizened old people, all realistic, all respectful. Then she took her work even further into the real world, enlisting a crew of people to build colorful, almost unbelievably jerry-built boats that they sailed down the Mississippi River and then down the Hudson. Swoon's given name is Caledonia Dance Curry. I met her at the Brooklyn Museum of Art, where she has her first big museum show right now. Only, turned out, I wasn't meeting her for the first time.
So, hi.
Oh, my goodness. Now that she says Cali, I remember it all.
It turned out that when she was an art student, before she was Swoon, she had given my grade school daughter Lucy art lessons at our house. Small world. Slightly magical world.
Come over here. We'll keep walking. So the real lineage...
The installation is called Submerged Motherlands. It's a kind of fantastical landscape. At the center, reaching all the way up toward the skylit dome at the top of the museum, is a tree, as big as any real tree.
Its interior is made out of a truss. It's a 60-foot truss system, and we had to install a lift point in the building in order to hoist it up, and then the sort of cables. And so there's obviously like a whole engineering that the fabric is hiding, but then the exterior is all hand-dyed and shredded fabric and cut paper leaves.
It's gorgeous, for starters, and you know, doesn't look like a real tree, but looks like it's real enough that it could be a magical tree.
Sure. Yeah, I definitely
dreams.
Had this thing where I felt like it's not that I wanted exactly to imitate nature, but I did want to create something that gave you that sort of experience of standing before something, which
the,
is...
The awesomeness.
Exactly.
I mean, this is a big thing. This fills a room. This is, I don't know, like a quarter acre.
It kind of is, right?
Resting against the trunk of the tree, like they were tied up at the edge of a river, are two of the handmade boats that she took down the real rivers, cobbled together by her and her friends. They're crazy-looking, ramshackle, cheerful, like something out of a cartoon.
Now we're at a boat. At
yes.
a boat. The first of
Isn't
a couple
she cute?
Of the first. It's incredibly cute. And of course, if people don't know, they'll think, "Oh, it's cute. This artist made this like Disney thing. It's like a boat."
Right.
But this was a boat.
This
that
is
you
a boat.
Took.
Yes.
Down the Hudson.
Yeah. So these are rafts. I mean, I kind of say, isn't she cute, jokingly. I mean, to me, it's not cute at all because I remember days and nights in the sea on this thing, which is...
In the sea?
And we were in the Adriatic Sea with it.
Well, this is the same one you took
to
Venice.
Yeah, we took them to Venice and on the Hudson.
So you started doing this back in 2006.
In 2006.
On the Mississippi.
Yes.
And that's where you figured out how to do this? I mean,
exactly.
Let's talk about it. It looks like just a pile of crap, pile of old wood.
Yes. Well, it is actually all reclaimed wood from construction sites. This boat to the right, name is Alice, and she has got two styrofoam pontoons decked across joisted like a floor, like the floor of a house, and then kind of these knotty, tangly sort of roots, which for me were sort of reminiscent of the mangrove swamps. The feeling of a kind of a self-built city meets a sort of a city that is becoming a slightly organic form Maria, the next boat, she's a little bit, has more of the shape of a regular boat. There's a kitchen in the front. We cooked from there. So you see all the burners and the pots and pans and the cheese grater and all of that stuff. That's where we prepared
so
all the
meals for
30
people.
So this is
the real stuff that was part of these adventures.
This is
a thing in the front.
So should
we
take you on these boats? We should do it.
Can
come
we?
On. Yeah, let's
May
go.
We?
Come on.
But is
you're
that special? I mean, people who come here won't be able
no,
to do
No, you can't, but you're here with me, so
okay.
Let's just sneak on.
Are now I gotta climb up?
Yeah, climb up. It's a little dirty. And I don't know if that was the best spot, but you're up. So.
Okay.
So here we are. So you can imagine that you would get to stand here at this glorious kitchen counter with all your pots and pans. Here's where you would stir fry for all your friends. Here's where you would cook your coffee in the morning. And you just watch the sea go by while you cook.
The sea being the Adriatic.
Being the Adriatic.
Being part of
the
Mediterranean.
Or the Hudson. Yeah, or
really?
The Hudson. And and so here, this was kind of largely the mechanical boat. We kept all of our, here's our flare gun. Here's hammers,
so were these, I mean, obviously, winch. They became your friends, presumably, but did they start out as just your friends, or?
The people who
the
I
people
made the boat
who
with?
Did this with you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we all knew each other. Whew, sorry about that.
It's okay.
It's much, much easier to do from a dock. So,
We've disembarked
from the
boat.
They'd be moving around. It would be moving out at that point.
And you were on the Mississippi. It is like you are Tom or Huck or both, right?
It's kind of, yeah. And people really connected with it so much in that way. Along the river, people would constantly say, oh, I've always dreamed of doing this.
I'll bet. Having had these amazing adventures all over America, all over the world with these things, is it weird to see them here in the museum?
Yeah, I mean, for me, I think I planned on it, so it was okay. But for my collaborators, it was pretty emotional because these crafts really represent some of the most incredible times of our lives. And it's 5 years later, you know, we're all kind of different people in different places, and here we are pulling these things out of the crates. And as you can tell, like, they still stink of the sea.
Yeah, there's an aroma.
There's a lot of memories going on in here. And so I think for a lot of folks, it was really emotional and a little bit difficult to see them as artifacts rather than as, like, your floating home, this incredible place.
Around this stage-set mangrove swamp and these boats, there's a group of Swoon's portraits, cutouts pasted on board to make them life-size and larger than life. They're mostly female figures of very different kinds. A mother breastfeeding an infant, a demon figure sticking out her tongue scarily, but also a woman with the same cloud of curly hair as Swoon.
The title of this piece is called Submerged Motherlands. And
of the whole thing.
Of the whole entire installation. And like I said, when I first created these boats, I was thinking a lot about climate change and floods. And then Sandy struck, and so I was kind of continuing in that vein of thinking. And then as I was working on this installation, my mother became sick with cancer and passed away. And she was a person who she just had a really difficult life, and I had a difficult relationship with her. She struggled with addiction and mental illness and depression.
Heroin and everything.
Heroin and alcohol and just everything you can imagine. I mean, you know, I was born in the 70s. She, you know, they were just total wild children, and I...
That is to say your parents.
My parents, yeah. And so the demon figure that you saw was kind of me processing some images that I had around my mother in her kind of worst state. But so this drawing here kind of takes a bit of a look at kind of life cycles
and
birth and death.
So this is our life-size portraits cut out and put up here of your mom at various
Yeah, so here she is. You can see sort of my mother as a young woman, and you see sort of pelvis and fetus, and these are kind of crones, kind of both death bringers and life bringers. You can see them kind of giving birth too. So,
and
that's my sister as the baby in my mom's arms.
Just behind those portraits is a little structure, a hut where you can sit down. We did, and Callie talked more about climate change in her work as Swoon, in particular how she tries to evoke real-world shanty towns, which are threatened especially by rising sea levels.
So you can see it kind of in Alice, like how there's a slight kind of shanty feeling to some of these structures. And, you know, it's not in a sense of like cultural appropriation that I want to directly borrow the language of the shanty. But I think that I imagined them, maybe it's like a little slightly kind of sci-fi thinking or something, but like bits of cities that had sort of broken off from their coastal perches and kind of evolved and changed and moved around and perhaps were sort of in some way like seeking a home and a safety and a refuge.
So while Swoon's work has a sense of whimsy, it's also a way of addressing real threats. It reminds me of the movie Beasts of the Southern Wild, the fable about Hurricane Katrina. Swoon has also gone to Haiti to help build housing for people displaced by the 2010 earthquake, and here in the United States, to the desperate former steel town of Braddock, Pennsylvania, to help create a community center. Those efforts are not exactly art, but they use some of the same skills.
It's really important to me to not just take on subjects, but to actually work in situ and to try to use creative problem solving to tackle the issues directly. And I think in a way it's just because I'm such a concrete thinker that I just think if I'm thinking about this, if I'm worried about this, if I'm concerned about it, let's get our hands on it. How can we be involved? How can we start to be part of the process?
You're amazing. I love you.
Thank you so much. And thanks for climbing on that dirty old boat with me. You were brave.
No, I feel like I was part of it. And there was no gangplank. I just had to get up
it's
there.
It's true. Right. In one way, it's harder because we had to sort of leap off onto the marble. But in another way, it was easier because if you can imagine, half the time is usually moving. We had a lot of falling between the boats going on. Yeah.
People are
going
to love this.
Great. Thank you so much.
You can see pictures of some of Swoon's work at studio360.org. Her exhibit, Submerged Motherlands, is up at the Brooklyn Museum in New York through the end of August.
I'll build a boat steady and true. As soon as it's done, I'm gonna sail.
So this is kind of amazing. The same guy who masterminded this
for my theme song, my leather black jeans on, my by any means on, partin' I'm getting my screen.
Also produced this.
I know I have a fickle heart and a bitterness and a wandering eye and a heaviness in my head.
And this.
Nothing can stop me now, cause
and this.
There'll be a golden ladder reaching down when the man comes around.
In the recording industry, there are producers, and then there are producers. And then there's Rick Rubin, who's more like some kind of music wizard. 30 years ago, when he was still in college, he joined up with Russell Simmons to found the pioneering hip-hop label Def Jam. Together, they launched a music empire, producing important records by Public Enemy, LL Cool J, and the Beastie Boys, among others. But just as Def Jam and hip-hop began to get really big, Rubin left, started his own label, and diversified. Since then, he's worked with scores of artists, from Nine Inch Nails to Johnny Cash, Metallica, Neil Diamond, the Dixie Chicks, Jay-Z. I could go on. Rick Rubin, welcome to Studio 360.
Hello, a pleasure meeting you.
And you. And to start, I want to play one of the first songs you produced back in 1984. It's Yours by Tila Rock and Jazzy Jay.
Commentating, illustrating, description giving, adjective expert, analyzing some of the musical myths, seeking people of the universe. This is Yours.
So there you are, going to NYU, this suburban kid who'd listened to punk rock, and suddenly you're at the center of this new hip-hop thing in New York City. How did that happen?
Well, I was hard at the center of it. I was witnessing what was happening, and it felt like a magical time in music because there was this new energy, and it felt like very much like punk rock, but different. And I think the difference between hip hop and punk rock was a lot of people rejected punk rock, whereas a lot of people accepted hip hop.
And is that partly because punk rock, part of the punk rock ethos, was to seek rejection?
I don't think so. I just think people didn't get it as much, or the audience wasn't as open-minded towards it. My particular case, I'm an only child, and I think most of the other kids that I went to school with kind of got their musical taste from their older brothers and sisters. It kind of got passed down.
Uh-huh.
And because I didn't have that, whatever was going on at the moment had more potential for me to engage in it. And at that time, punk rock was the one that spoke to me.
Uh-huh.
Whereas in hip hop, it was different. And with hip hop, it seemed like there was a much more of a community right from the beginning of people embracing it.
And pretty soon, you're founding Def Jam Records with Russell Simmons. You're producing these huge albums for Run DMC and LL Cool J and Public Enemy. What was it like being the white guy in the middle of this black musical revolution?
It was a little strange in that everybody else was black. But very quickly, as soon as we started talking about music, after the initial shock of them meeting me, after that, it was all good.
And then you helped introduce the first big white rappers to the world in the Beastie Boys. I want to play a little bit of the new style from their debut record in 1986, Licensed to Ill.
Let me clear my throat. Kick it over here, baby pop. And let all the fly skimmers feel the beat. Drop. Cooling on the corner.
So just after you've exposed rap music to the wider world, you let these three artsy upper-middle-class Jewish kids kind of walk all over it. Did that seem like a very transgressive punk rock thing to do at the time?
Well, we were all friends from punk rock. The Beasties were a punk rock band before they became a rap band. And I would say we always had a sort of a punk rock aesthetic in all the Def Jam stuff. It was like a renegade version of hip hop.
And all of that early Def Jam hip hop, Run DMC and Public Enemy, and all sounds of its time, and yet today has such staying power. And you hear all these songs in movies and in bars. And does it surprise you, that sort of endurance?
It's hard to say. I had no expectation of anybody really ever hearing this music. We made it really for our friends. That said, we thought it was really good. And I just think the perspective that we made it from, it wasn't about being timely. It was about being pure and good and capturing a real moment. So real moments tend to sound good always.
You will always be associated with the rap music of the 80s, but you'll also always be associated with the late career resurgence of Johnny Cash. I want to play a little bit of I See a Darkness from American 3, Solitary Man, which came out in 2000.
And light it up forever and never go to sleep. My best unbeaten brother, this isn't all I see. Although I see a darkness, although I see a darkness.
Did Johnny Cash come to you, or did you go to him?
I went to him. I had an idea because I had a new label at the time, and all of the artists I was working with were first-time artists, young artists, and I thought it'd be a fun challenge to find a grown-up artist who maybe hadn't been doing their best work and try to help them recapture what was great about them. And Johnny was the first person I thought of.
You've said that the music industry does a terrible job of properly cherishing artists who have been around for a long time. I wonder if your, you know, universally acclaimed and successful work with Johnny Cash changed that industry instinct at all.
Well, I do know one of the things that it shifted was several other older artists that I met in the wake of that had a renewed sense of possibility of doing good work.
Speaking of older artists, Neil Diamond. You made an album with him about a decade ago called 12 Songs.
You can tell them this. Hell yeah, he did. He saw it all. He walked the line. Never had to crawl. He
cried a bit, but not for long. Hell yeah,
how did that come about? Did Neil Diamond come to you and say, hey, do for me what you did for Johnny Cash?
Okay, I will say that is not exactly the way it happened. I went to him.
Uh-huh.
I pursued him for a long time just because
really?
I'm a big fan of his early work, and I thought it would be really fun to make a great Neil Diamond record. And it was so different than anything I'd done before,
yes.
Which is always an interesting challenge
yeah.
for me. It's really fun to find new creative challenges.
In the last few years, you've returned to hip-hop in a big way, producing for Jay-Z and Eminem and Kanye West. What is it like now mentoring artists, Eminem and Kanye certainly, who grew up on the music you produced 30 years ago? They must regard you differently as this 50-year-old wizard than people did 30 years ago as this 25-year-old kid.
Punk.
Punk, okay.
It's hard to say. I will say very quickly when you get into the actual work, all that stuff goes away. And same from my side, you know, when I get to work with – if I go into the studio with someone like Neil Young or, mm-hmm. You know, so there are certain people who are really important artists to me. Initially, when you are around these people, there's a sense of intimidation just because their body of work is so great. But very quickly, when you start listening to the music and talking about the music, all that stuff goes away and it really is just about music.
Right. Kanye came to you, I've read, last year, just weeks before his album Yeezus was supposed to be released. Were you not tempted to say, no, we can't do it in this amount of time? We can't fix whatever you need fixing?
Yeah, I didn't think it was realistic or doable. And then it ended up being, we probably worked for probably about 20 days every day. It was really a challenging and fun process.
I'm doing 500, I'm out of control. But there's nowhere to go, and there's no way to slow. If I knew what I knew in the past, I would have been blacked out on your ass.
And it was a huge album and acclaimed by everybody, so it apparently worked. But I'm wondering, given this intensity, and was that kind of interesting for your process, since that's not presumably how you work ordinarily?
Yeah, it is not how I work at all. And and I was panicky, and he was completely cool.
Huh.
And as it turns out, it's the way he works best. So while it was an unusual experience for me, I think ultimately it's about what works for the artist.
It strikes me just talking to you today that part of your wizardry is your even-keeledness with artists in these what can be, we know, very frenetic, pressured, difficult times of making a record. Do you think that's true?
Absolutely. And I think one of the things that I try to bring to the table when we're working is a sense of all of those things which ultimately get in the way of the art being great. We don't include those in our conversation. And we don't talk about, you know, what's going to get on the radio and what's going to, you know, how are we going to make our release date. We talk about how do we make this song as good as it could be? Is this song good enough? Which of these songs are better? Those are the conversations. And when the sole focus is on making good things and you clear the decks of all of the noise, it so far has yielded really great results.
Well, Rick Rubin, it has been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Def Jam Records is celebrating its 30th anniversary right now with reissues of some of their truly groundbreaking albums, from Public Enemy's Icon to Kanye West's 808s and Heartbreak.
Hit me. Look back on my life and my life gone. Where did I go wrong?
Still ahead this hour, one of indie music's favorite songwriters recalls the battle days.
I didn't sound like Nina Simone, and I wasn't writing Joni Mitchell songs, so life was not worth living.
I didn't say anything that I wanted to say to you.
Joan as Policewoman is just ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Lumosity.com. The brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com.
You're listening to Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. For more than a decade, Joan Wasser made good in supporting roles in the punk band The Dam Builders, playing violin with Anthony and the Johnsons, touring with Rufus Wainwright. But then in 2002, she stepped forward and established her own indie pop career. And she gave it a name, Joan as Policewoman.
I know that it hurts you, well, it hurts me too.
Her sound is soulful and sexy, sometimes with lyrics so frank they might make you blush. Her new record, The Classic, is just out, and she joins me now in the studio with her band. Welcome to Studio 360.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So you have been performing as Joan, as Policewoman, for a dozen years, I think, about. How did that come to be, that name?
Well, when I began writing songs, I was going under my given name, which before that I had really only been a violin player.
Right.
So people thought that I was doing solo violin shows. So I realized I needed a name for the music that I made.
And you had played the violin, seriously, classical violin, since you were a little kid and through college at BU and with the Boston Symphony. And so where and how and why did that detour into pop music happen?
I loved studying classical music. I knew I had absolutely nothing to contribute to the Beethoven concerto that already hadn't happened, you know?
Yeah.
And
was that scary when you realized that, given that you'd spent, you know, a lot of time devoting yourself, investing yourself in that?
Not really.
No?
I always listened to a lot of different kinds of music and was going to punk rock shows when I was a teenager while, you know, also playing violin. And I didn't actually see that much of a difference between classical music and any other kind of music.
Had you played other kinds of music, though, or not? So
I had played along secretly to Jimi Hendrix. That was about it.
Well, we've all done that.
Yeah, thank you. You're right. But no, I hadn't. And when I got to college, I started, you know, playing with my guitarist friends. And I had to really learn how to not read off a page and trust myself that I would, you know, because that's all I had done. And, you know, to learn to just make the notes up yourself. It was like a leap of faith and was horrifying at times and mostly absolutely glorious.
But at that point, did you know or had you decided, okay, music is my life. This is what I'm going to do.
Yeah.
Make my art and earn a living.
Yeah, it was really the only thing that made me feel like life was worth living. I mean, basically.
Well, then you'd better do it.
You know, it was the thing that gave me joy otherwise. So I just went from there and started writing songs and started singing, hating both of those outputs for a long time.
Hating what you, how you sounded and what you wrote.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I wasn't, you know, I didn't sound like Nina Simone and I wasn't writing Joni Mitchell songs instantly. So, you know, life was not worth living.
And then you're over 30. Do you feel like, I'm too old to do this at this point?
I don't really think that way, actually. I feel like maybe my base age is 8, and I'll always be 8. Yeah,
you're a very precocious 8-year-old in that case.
Thank you.
So will you play a song for us?
Sure.
Holy City, maybe?
Yes, yes. Is everyone somewhat ready for this experience?
Yeah.
Okay. Great. Talking in your eyes, well, they blew me away, yeah. Oh,
feel like I found you when I find myself beside you. And I want to tell you freely, but I don't know how to thank you. No, I don't know how to thank you. Won't you show me how to thank you? Cause I know that this a feeling, it's the feeling I've been waiting on.
That was Joan as policewoman playing Holy City off her new album, The Classic. Joan Wasser is joined by Eric Lane on synths and bass, Matt White on guitar, and Parker Kindred on drums. That song and this album have more of a, dare I say it, Motown feel than your previous records. What caused this?
A number of things. The records that I have made previously had a sort of polished feeling, and sort of like you can look inside my snow globe and see
this perfect
what's
world
there, sort of, yeah. And when I was touring on my last record, The Deep Field, a lot of people said, wow, you know, the live show is so powerful, so different from the recordings. And I was like, something's getting missed there that I want to try to find on this record.
But I'm wondering also, did you decide, I can really be a soul singer and
yes.
I can do this and bring it?
Yeah. I mean, I with each record, I tell more of the voices in my head that say, you can't do this, you can't do that, to take a hike.
Uh-huh.
You know, I really promised myself that I was just going to get to the end of the song and then decide it wasn't appropriate or for my voice or whatever. And then, of course, by the time you get to the end of the song, you're used to singing it in that way that you sort of hoped you might be able to. And, you know, I grew up listening to Motown and the Jackson 5 and Diana Ross and stuff, you know, so that's the first music I heard on the AM radio before I would go to elementary school. And, you know, it's...
And now you're an 8-year-old, or channeling that 8-year-old, I
thank
guess.
Thank you.
This record is also, compared to your earlier work, much of it, is so upbeat seeming. Is that also part of this, you know, saying no to the naysayers within and saying, I'm going to express this cheerfulness and hope that it becomes self-fulfilling? Or why is it so upbeat?
You know, I think the point of spending more time alive is to figure out how to do it better. You know, and I definitely used up the interest in self-destruction. And that's a glorious place to arrive. And then you have to figure out how to live again, you know. So, you know, Stevie Wonder writes songs that are really up but are not light.
Or saccharine, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. You know, I made it a point to make that a focus in my songwriting. Like, I really want it to overall feel like up but, like, you know, have depth. It's pretty easy to write a really sad song that's, like, totally fatalistic. And what's the point?
Leave that to the people in their 20s.
I'm gonna.
And do you have any worry, as I, you know, writers, comedians, our kinds of artists do sometimes, like, ooh, if I get happy, I'm not going to have material?
Well, I don't think any of us have to really worry about getting too happy. I mean, you know, life is really, really intense. And it's never going to just provide happiness all the time. I mean, so, yeah.
Have you ever, I mean, your songs are personal. They seem like personal stories. Have you ever regretted saying something in a lyric and put it out and like, yeah, I wish I hadn't done that later?
A lot of times when I write the lyrics initially, I think, no way is that going to make it into the final song. You know, that's too revealing or too embarrassing, or I could never, like, I don't want anyone to know that I felt that way or whatever. And then again, like, by the end of the song, it's like, everybody else has felt that in some way. It's, you know, I sort of liberate myself from like those feelings by saying them in public,
yeah.
You know, by outing myself.
Joan, thanks very much. And before you go, will you play us out with one more song? Get Direct?
Would love to.
That's Joan as Policewoman playing Get Direct off her new album, The Classic, with Eric Lane on synths and bass, Matt White on guitar, and Parker Kindred on drums. You can hear all the songs they played for us today, as well as a bonus track at studio360.org. And that's it for this hour of Studio 360. Thank you very much for listening. And don't forget to send us your cover version of W.C. Handy's Yellow Dog Blues. Everything you need to know to do it is at studio360.org. Mark Anthony Thompson, also known as Chocolate Genius, will join me in a couple of weeks to judge your entries. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Jenny Lawton,
John Delore,
Sean Ramisfirm,
Alana Harper,
Matt Frasica,
Eric Malinsky,
Julia Lowry Henderson,
Shruti Pinnamaneni,
Rose Connolly,
Eliza Martin,
Andres O'Hara Plotnick.
And thanks as always to WNYC's Chris Bannett. Our theme music is by David Van Tegum.
Studio 360 is supported by TiVo, able to search cable TV on-demand libraries, and streaming content from Netflix and Hulu Plus, all on a single screen. Available at TiVo.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Anika Noni Rose is starring on Broadway in A Raisin in the Sun, but she'd rather be a supervillain.
I want to fly and like bite somebody in the neck and then kick somebody else. Yeah.
That's Anika Noni Rose next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.